Let's go.
Oh, no.
Do you
want to
start? I'll let you.
I'm excited and I feel relaxed and I'm ready to party!
Let's say sorry.
You don't need to do that. You don't need to apologize. It's a fucked up female habit. You don't need to be sorry for anything ever.
Can you guess what every woman's worst nightmare is?
I don't have rage issues!
I have nothing to prove to you.
When I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
I say when it comes to stardom and Lauren, there are no accidents.
Hi, Karen Peterson.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Citizen Dame, the podcast where we just talk about ladies and different kinds of ladies and really interesting ladies. And we also have other ladies on. So I am your host, Lauren Humphreys Brooks. And with me, as always, is Karen Peterson.
Hello.
And we also have a very special guest today who's been on the podcast a couple of times now. And I'm very happy that she got to come on here. Nanina. Hello, Nanina.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
We love having you.
We enjoy having you. So Nanina is a screenwriter. She is a ridiculously knowledgeable film person who just does way too much research and puts me to shame. And is also one of my good friends from university. We've known each other for a long time.
About half our lives.
Yes, it's very... Oh my God, that's... Oh, don't say that. Don't say such things. Oh my God, I don't even want to think about that. Anyways, one of my good friends just had her second baby, and I'm just like, no, we're 19. We're not having babies. That's not real. That's not a thing that people do.
I made the realization this week that my 30th high school reunion is coming up this year.
What? My 20th is, but yeah.
I had a question the other day with someone that I was chatting with about, like, when did you graduate college? I was like, 2008? And like, it took me a moment. I could not remember. And at first I was like, 2004. No, that was high school. That was high school. I definitely graduated high school in 2004.
So, I graduated high school in 1994. So yeah.
I've been doing calculations about how old you actually are, Karen, because I don't think you've ever actually said. So I like, and someone actually asked me, how old is Karen? I was just like, well, I've been triangulating based upon various things that she has said.
47. I will just answer that. All I have right, no problems with it. I am 47. I am the same age as Star Wars.
Yeah,
we both came out the same year.
Going to say, I think that Karen came out the same year as Star Wars. So.
Yep. Yeah.
It's true.
I don't know what year Star Wars came out, so that was one of the things that I had to triangulate.
Shame. Shame.
I have no memory. I have no memory for dates either. Like, I've also thought that I was 38 for a very long time. I'm not. I'm 37. I still think I'm 38. I'm going to think I'm 38 until I actually turn 30, and then I'm going to think I'm 40.
Yeah. So I do that too, though. It's like, because my birthday's in February, like once the new year starts, then I just start thinking like, okay, I'm this age that I'm about to turn because it's early in the year. But then when I actually hit my birthday, I can't remember. So like this year I've been like, wait, am I now 47 or was I 47 and I turned 48? Like I have to do the math. I can't remember.
I had to ask my parents. It's like, wait, how old am I? And then they were like, you're 37. Like, do you know what year you were born? I was like, but not really. I'm 38. You're not 38. So today we are actually going to talk about someone. We're going to talk about Kinuyo Tanaka, who is a really interesting figure who I had never heard of. And one of the reasons why I wanted Nanina to come on was because you were the first. Like person who ever mentioned this woman's name to me, and then got very excited when a collection popped up on Criterion Channel that puts together six of her films as a director. And so this is someone that I've actually seen in a number of films because she started in lead roles from the time she was about 20 years old in Ozu's I Graduated But, which is in 1929. And then she also appears in films like Ugetsu. She is in Redbeard. So she's one of these faces that like you recognize from a lot of Japanese films, if you know Japanese films from that time period, really beginning in the 1930s all the way through to the 60s. But she's also a film director, a feature director. She's the second Japanese woman to work as a film director within the Japanese film industry. And second only to Tazuko Sakane, who was a major film, like one of the very first filmmakers. And Nanina, you had stuff to say about her initially. So why don't we start with you and then we can talk about Tanaka specifically.
Well, so Tazuko Sakane is the first known Japanese woman director and certainly the first one to work within any sort of Japanese studio system. And her career started, I think that perhaps the easiest parallel to make with her in terms of Hollywood terms is the way that Dorothy Arzner came into filmmaking. Tazuko Sakane started out as continuity and assistant directing and screenwriting and editing, which she did mainly with Kenji Mizoguchi. I've been practicing his name and I always stumble over it. And
understandable.
And so she, in 1936, got to direct her first, got to move into the directing chair, her first feature film. She did not get to choose the subject of it, and it was very poorly received. And she, in general, was treated a lot worse than Dorothy Arzner was in Hollywood. She never got to direct another fiction feature film after 1936's New Year's Finery. But she did go on to have a career directing propaganda documentaries, a lot of them in China, actually. when she made the move to directing documentaries in China, it was at just the time that Kenyuyo Tanaka started working with Mizoguchi.
Very often I've heard it pronounced Mizoguchi, which might not be the correct pronunciation, but is the more, I guess, anglicized one.
So they would have known each other, were overlapping a little bit on his films in 1940. And then after the war, Tazuko Sakane came back to Japan, but didn't have access to being a director anymore because the rules had changed. And there was this new arbitrary rule that a director had to have a college degree, which I don't know how that worked with Kenyuyo Tanaka, because I'm not sure if she did, but she was much more famous. So Sakane then had to go back into being Mizoguchi's assistant director. And so again, around 1948, she would have been collaborating on films that Kenyuyo Tanaka was starring in. And this is around the time that Kenyuyo Tanaka started thinking about the idea of moving into directing. She was in her 40s. She was considered the biggest star in Japan. She was the highest paid female star. And she was known, all of the American articles really liked to emphasize that she's considered the Betty Davis of Japan. And in 1949, Kenyuyo Tanaka did a sort of goodwill tour of Hollywood. And I think that this timing is interesting because it's the exact time that another actress that was compared with Betty Davis was moving into the directing chair, Ida Lupino. And I think that the best sort of analogy for Kenyo Tanaka in Hollywood would be an Ida Lupino. I don't know if they ever met each other during that Goodwill tour. It seems likely that they would have, but Not Wanted, Ida Lupino's first film, was released mm-hmm. and attracting a huge amount of publicity because it had made over $1 million on a very small budget. So I think that both the sort of seeing an actress moving into the directing chair on that Goodwill tour of Hollywood, and also knowing Tatsuko Sakane, that these connections really help people, women, feel that they can make that step. And yeah. So in 1952, Kenyo Tanaka made the effort to become part of the Japanese Directors Union and step into the shoes of director. Interestingly, though, several of her former directors were really supportive of her. Mizoguchi, who hired a lot of women in that he had Tetsuko Sakane as his assistant director, and is known as one of the, I read somewhere that he was the most feminist Japanese director of that time. And I'm like, I think you're forgetting about Kenyo Tanaka. But he did not support her move to directing, mm-hmm. And actively worked against it, which ended their collaboration after 14 films. And her first film was Love Letter, which I mm-hmm. think is the first film that we're going to talk about.
Yes. So just to go back really quickly, I think that that's a really mm-hmm. good, that's a good analogy between her and Ida Lupino, because you've got two women who started out as actresses and were not small actresses either. These were not women who were playing good parts. They were playing major roles, right, for major filmmakers. And then at some point, and as you point out, I think that the age question is an interesting one, because you've got an industry where the older a woman gets, the less likely she is to certainly get lead roles. And is kind of maybe falling back into bit character parts if she's playing roles at all. And then you've got these two women who have worked with these very famous filmmakers, have been within the system for a very long time, and are kind of like, actually, I think I could do this. And so it's interesting to kind of see those parallels, regardless of whether or not they ever actually met or whether there was a direct influence between the two of them. It's interesting that this is also happening then in like the late 40s into the early 50s. And then for Tanaka, certainly into the 1960s. So it's an interesting parallel to consider, and the way in which women were able to get those opportunities and were to kind of building their own opportunities within this incredibly patriarchal, incredibly male dominated system. So the Mizoguchi thing, I was reading about that, because there was this whole thing about like they may have even had a relationship with each other, like a romantic relationship, and here's this one guy who's one of the most powerful directors in the Japanese film industry at the time, actively opposing her becoming a filmmaker, which definitely says a lot. And it definitely says a lot that this was more than just a rift that was created between the two of them. Like it was a split. They no longer work together after that. So it's an interesting thing. I mean, I think that, Mizoguchi should get some honors for some of the ways that he portrays women in his films, definitely. But yeah, claiming that, you know, this is the most feminist filmmaker or whatever, that's an open question. And there's also a question about, that kind of thing that we typically talk about, we've talked about a lot on this podcast, of men being willing to go along with feminist principles to a certain degree, and then suddenly if a woman is directly threatening them, or is, you know, kind of being like, well, I can do something similar to what you do, they're suddenly like, not we don't like that.
And two of the films that we're going to talk about The screenplays were written by directors that Kenyo Tanaka collaborated with and collaborated with deep into her career afterwards. So she definitely had support. But yeah, it is very disappointing, the reaction that Mizoguchi had. I also think that his feminism tends to lean in the direction of being happy to show women suffering and how hard it is to be a woman. But sometimes I think that his grasp on women's interactions aren't as deep as some people claim.
Which is such an unusual thing that men never do, especially nowadays.
It's one of those things I'm like, okay, you know what? I will maybe give a little bit of forgiveness to, you know, a male director in the 1940s and 50s in Japan, but I am not going to forgive, you know, forgive that in to a male director in, you know, 2020 or whatever. But yeah, that's a very good point, is that there is that sort of brand of more male feminism that is like, oh, it's really tough to be a girl. It really sucks being female. It's like, I mean, you're not wrong sometimes, but also that's not the only thing. Like, can we talk about that a little bit? So,
and also, yeah, let's talk a little bit more about why that might be.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's that. Well, and I think that going into the films that we're going to talk about, one of the things that I quite like about all three of the films in different ways is that there is a discussion and focus on the kind of trials and tribulations of being female and of being particularly working class female in this incredibly, you know, difficult patriarchal and also post-war society. These are all post-war films, and they're all dealing with kind of the aftermath of not really what happened to the men during the war, but what happened to the women, the things that the women had to go through, and how that also related to this more masculine culture and the shifting culture that was going on in Japan at the time, which is, you know, also one of the things that Ozu deals with, is one of the things that Kurosawa deals with, is one of the things that Mizoguchi deals with to a certain degree. But all three of her films are very much, all three of these films are very much filtered through a female perspective, and female perspective on men sometimes, but also just a female perspective on women, and not just the suffering that women undergo in this kind of situation, but the issues that women have to deal with within this kind of post-war nascent, you know, it's that shift that's going on in Japan that was going on in most of the countries across the world, of dealing with the aftermath of the war, but also shifting into this new kind of industrialization, this new culture, and the influences that the culture has on that shift in culture is having on society itself. So let's talk about Love Letter, which was Tanaka's first film from 1953. And this film focuses on a few different things, but primarily on this one man who has returned from war and is basically unmoored. He is not able to, he's not really getting a job. He lives with his brother. He doesn't really know what he wants to do. He has this kind of strong connection to this woman from his past that he hasn't been able to find. He keeps on going to the train station looking for her. Doesn't really know what happened to her. And he winds up getting a job with a friend to transcribe in English love letters from Japanese women to their American GI lovers who have gone back to the United States, very often asking for money or for support, or sometimes just simply to say like, hey, I still exist. And you said you were going to come back, or you said you were going to support me. And through this, he then reconnects with this woman from his past. So, Karen, do you want to talk a little bit about what your impressions were for this? You don't have to talk tons. I know that you're not feeling great, but I would love to hear your perspective on this to start.
So, as was already stated, this is her first film, and I think that just overall, my impression as a debut. Granted, yes, she had a lot of experience in film, had been on a lot of sets, had starred in a lot of movies, but. But I think that as a debut film, I think that this is very accomplished. I think that it's really beautifully shot. the use of space, the use of just these really beautiful landscapes and even interiors, I think that it just really shows her understanding of how to use everything that's available to you to craft a story that is also very intimate and very personal. I think so that was just something that really stood out to me as I was watching it, was just that it's just beautiful to look at.
I love the way she films architecture and spaces.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And like, you really get a sense for just the way people live, not just in their homes, but in the society too. Just like going into restaurants or going into, into parks or wherever they are. It's all part of helping craft the story and understanding these, her characters' lives. And, I really enjoyed that. And then I think just as the story unfolds too, you really get such a good understanding, through the way that it's written, but also through the performances that she draws from the actors. You just get really such a good sense of the very difficult nature of the emotions. Like you mentioned, this is definitely a post-war story but it's not that long after the war. And so people are still recovering from the trauma of that experience, but also the fallout of it and kind of where they're left to pick up the pieces of their lives and the lives of the people around them. And so I think that she just does such a beautiful job of really helping you understand the fraught emotions that people are experiencing. And in such a way where it's like, it's easy to get mad at a character for a choice that they make, but it's also like, you have to pull back and go, wait, let's look at what they're actually dealing with and what's not being said too. So I, overall, I really thought this was such a beautiful film in so many ways.
It really is.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that, and it's a good point that it does feel like a very mature film. We've talked about this before. I think when it comes to certain female filmmakers, that it's like, maybe it is that they've just been around the industry for so long that they know how to frame something. They know how film works in a really deep way. And you definitely get that sense with this film. One of the things I really liked about it is it switches perspective almost. You get the male perspective for so long and kind of his story, what this woman that he's looking for, the sense that he doesn't really know, he's very empathetic to the women that he's working with, but he doesn't really know what he's after. He's kind of wandering around being like, I don't know what to do with my life. And then when he finds her again, and he's very disappointed in her, and he's very disappointed in kind of the veneration that he has built up for her. And in the reality that she has lived. And then the perspective shifts. It shifts much more to her. It becomes much more about like what her past has been and the blame that she has also laid upon herself for the choices that she has made. And it's very deft, because you almost don't see the perspective shift, but suddenly we're looking at things from her versus him. And it's that moment where like he sees her through the curtain. He sees like part of her through the curtain, realizes who she is, and then chases after her. And then they run into each other in the train station. And then there's a shift that happens. It's very subtle, but it's very, very well done. So Nanino, you had thoughts as well.
I mean, I just have to reiterate what Karen said of how beautiful this film is, and the way that she films post-war Tokyo. There's a scene where they're walking together through a park, and it's just one of the most devastating scenes ever, but it's so beautiful. There's mist coming through, and the moments that she chooses close-ups and the moments that she chooses long shots are very chosen. And also the scene in the rain with the brother seeking out the woman that the older brother has been looking for. And I, the younger brother character, I love so much. He is such a sweet, the relationship between the brothers, and actually the relationship between all of the men in this film, I think is really a wonderful look at masculinity and very tender. The friend that gets him the job at writing the love letters is a great character as well. And these men are really looking out for each other. And I think one thing that Kinyo Tanaka really excelled at was in collaboration, and especially in interpreting screenplays while putting her own mark on them, because she didn't write them, but also allowing the voice of the screenwriter to come through. So in this case, it was Keisuke Kinoshita, and he was a great director in Japan at the time, and she had collaborated with him. And I think one thing that's quite interesting about his particular perspective is that he was gay. And there is some the first scene of Love Letter, you have the younger brother coming home to this apartment that he and his older brother share, but you don't quite know that they're brothers to begin with. And I watched the film with my cousin, and he was like, at first I was wondering if this was going to be a super progressive film, and that, because there is this tenderness and domesticity that is allowed for these men to have with each other. And I think that Kinoshita's life and experiences as a gay man in Japan informed that, and that ambiguity, obviously it's a sibling relationship, but it's not reading too much into it to also see some queer elements to just the way these men are living in a domestic space and taking on roles that are considered more feminine, of cooking and doing the laundry and all of these things. And I really love that about this film, that it's an interesting look at post-war masculinity. And the other thing that that is a funny similarity between this film and the second film we'll talk about, The Moon Has Risen, is the looking at sibling relationships where the younger sibling did not have to directly be involved in the fighting of the war.
Yeah.
That was younger for the bulk of the war. And the older sibling that did have to, and the different perspectives on romance between these two micro generations, even though they're technically the same generation. And the younger brother is a much more hopeful person. And he brings that hope in trying to help his brother out of this sort of post-war malaise and depression. And I think that's really beautiful, the way that that's portrayed.
Well, and to go back to that question, I mean, the ambiguous relationships, which I think we should talk about also in the next one, because I was very confused for the next film about the relationships between some of these people. But that ambiguous relationship and that well, you say that domesticity, but also the empathy that the men show, particularly for the women, and particularly the younger brother and the friend, who is kind of much more, who's about the same, they're about the same age, and is much more kind of, it's not quite cynical, but a little bit more world weary than the younger brother, and is kind of seen a lot and heard a lot. He's one of those kinds of characters. But this, like, there's a point where he and the, fairly close to the end of the film, where he and the older brother have this, like, conflict that he's basically like, you know, he's essentially like, how dare you, you know, how dare you talk about her in this way when you don't know what she has gone through and the things that she has had to do. And it is, it's that perspective also that, you know, the women went through the war as well. They went through it in a different way. And even in the United States, some of the best post-war films in the United States also focus on the fact that the women experienced the war. Some of them actually went to war in various ways, but you know, everybody went through it, right? And did things and said things and had to be involved with things that they didn't necessarily want to be. And then also were kind of, again, unmoored, that sense of like disconnection and not knowing what had happened to people. In Japan, you have this whole issue of repatriation where there are, you know, people scattered all across the world and they might be alive. They might be dead. They might be in prison camps. They might be missing. They might not be missing. They might have like completely walked off the face of the earth and they don't know where they are. And as you've got families who are waiting, not just for a couple of months, but for years and years and years to know if their child is going to come home or their husband or their son or whoever. Or their brother. And I think that all of the men in particular, like you say, those secondary male characters show this degree of empathy for the female experience. And kind of not necessarily saying, well, she had to do it and, you know, she would never have done it if you had been there, all of that, but more saying like, we have to be forgiving and we have to be kind about this because you don't know what she had to go through. It's a very empathetic film. Everybody is very empathetic to everybody else. And you kind of see the anger that the older brother has, but it's also an anger that's attached to him kind of building up this story in his head about who this woman was and who she was going to be when he found her again. And then obviously her falling short of that and her blaming herself for it.
Yeah. And I think that empathy is really what makes this film work so well, is because, I mean, as you say, there's so much happening emotionally and psychologically with all these characters. And it would be easy to just, you know, get mad at him for some of the things that he says to her. But because we're able to understand what he's been through, it makes it a lot easier to not dismiss or ignore what he says, but to contextualize it in a way where it's like, mm-hmm. No, we were rooting for him and for them ultimately.
Yeah, we're rooting for them and we understand them, I think. There are definitely a few times where I'm just like, well, fuck you too, dude.
Yeah.
like, bro, are you kidding me? Like, chill out. But it is, it also feeds into, you know, and if I've not lived in Japan, I'm not gonna say I have a great deal of knowledge of Japanese culture, but I've seen a lot of Japanese films. And one of the things that comes through in a lot of Japanese films is this very strict understanding of right and wrong and of morality and of the way that your personal morality reflects on everyone else in your life, reflects on your family, reflects on everybody who's attached to you, and having to deal with that then in a post-war setting where they've lost the war and there is all of this social and cultural upheaval going on and all of these people kind of trying to figure out where they fit into this very structured society. And not being able to do it really well. And the fact that this film does have a great deal of empathy for everyone involved is very moving and unexpected. I did not expect, honestly, a Japanese film of this period to be as empathetic as it was to everyone, in you know, especially the women. So let's move on to a slightly lighter film. Slightly lighter, much lighter.
A delightful film.
The Moon Has Risen, which is a 1955 film. It is a romantic comedy. And it was also scripted. So it's directed by Tanaka. It was also scripted by Ryosuke Sato and Ozu, who is, you know, everybody knows who Ozu is. And this is definitely, you can tell that if you've seen any Ozu films, this is definitely an Ozu script. Like, it's, you can feel it. And so it's mileage may vary on this one. I have some issues with Ozu films. But this one is kind of it's a very standard rom-com, actually. Like, it's a family who are all living in their father's house. And one of the reasons why I was saying that I was confused about some of the relationships is that for the longest time, I thought all of these people were related to each other, especially the younger sister and the guy that is not her brother, but I thought was her brother for a long section of the film. And I don't know if I just wasn't paying close enough attention to it, but then I was like, oh, he must not be her brother. I am wrong about that. But that's the thing. So, because these are all people who knew each other growing up, and that's one of the things that is kind of represented. And they're also all living fairly close together, even within the same housing complex, basically. And so I got quite confused. But yeah, so Nina, why don't you start us off on this one? What are your thoughts on The Moon Has Risen?
I really love it. Though I think that that confusion that you had about the relationship between the characters might have made it a little harder to just navigate what was going on. It's the story of a widower with, so many people describe it as being three daughters. Actually, technically, he has two daughters and one daughter-in-law living with him. The oldest one was married to his son, who we assume died in the war. They live in Nara, Japan, which is a really lovely bucolic sort of temple area outside of the cities. And there's a bit of the tension between this beautiful bucolic setting and the young people wanting to go off to Tokyo to be in the center of it all. Though I feel like to post-war audiences in Japan, this film, though it does deal tangentially with post-war experiences, it must have been kind of a respite. It's just so lovingly and beautifully filmed. These temple complexes and this really beautiful home that these girls are living in. There are the three young women living under the same roof, and the youngest one, who's 21, and played absolutely delightfully by Mie Kitahara, who has a really, I feel, young Audrey Hepburn quality to her. I really liked her as an actress.
She's great. She's great. Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt. I just, like, every time she came on screen, she's just like, she's having a wonderful time. She's such a happy person. Mm-hmm. Just like, and also, girl, you are fucking things up.
But yes, she and this student that lives in sort of an annex of their house try to set up the middle sister with a friend of his, and they are not always successful. There's a very amusing scene where Kinuyo Tanaka herself has a small role in the film as the household's maid, and there's a scene with directing her own director on how to deliver a phone conversation, and they're rehearsing together, and it's a fun little switching of perspective if you know a little bit about the background of the film. But yeah, it's a sort of family relationship drama and romantic comedy, and as you said, it's very Uzo, which again I feel is Kinuyo Tanaka's ability to be sensitive in interpreting other people's scripts and definitely having her own mark on it, but also allowing the voice of the screenwriter to shine through, which is a real skill.
It's a very slow-paced film in a lot of ways. Like when I was, and again, some of this might also be my issue with Ozu to begin with, is that Ozu is very leisurely. Ozu takes a long time, like any of the films that he directed, he takes a long time to set things up, takes a long time to get through things. And so there were definitely points for this film where I was like, can we please, you know, get it moving. But I think that it does kind of, it develops really well. And I do think that you need that leisurely pace to kind of allow for the characters to develop a little bit, as given the way that the film is structured. And then you get to kind of these, not mistaken identity, but sort of like, oh, we're going to have these machinations where we'll like get them together in the same room, or we're going to get them to go out together. And the sister's like, no, no. But actually she is kind of, she's definitely developing feelings for this guy. And you've got all of this back and forth that's going on between the sisters, and the younger sister being like, well, why wouldn't you want to do this? Because you should go away and get married and have this wonderful life. It's that very romantic notion. And then of course she then has to turn it back on herself, and understand her own feelings. So it is one of those that's a very straightforward romantic comedy in a lot of ways, but then is given a lot more depth because of the pacing and because of the cinematography is fantastic. It's gorgeous. And again, very different to what we see in Love Letter.
Please don't hate me for saying this.
I know.
No, I really liked it. I really liked it a lot. One of the things that I was thinking as I was watching it was, for anybody, because we all know, getting some people to watch films from other countries that are subtitled is sometimes challenging. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I thought was, for people who love romantic movies, this could be a really good entry point for some folks, especially for people who love Jane Austen.
I can see that. Yes.
Yeah. It is very Austen-esque, actually. I don't know why you would be like, oh, don't hate me.
Well, I mean, I love Jane Austen, but I know that that's sometimes an overly used comparison for people. So that's why I was like, ugh. But yeah, I really think that anybody who's really into Austen, but who's reticent to launch into subtitled movies, I think this could be one that is a good transition for you.
Well, and so often we don't, you know, I know that a lot of the big Japanese films that we talk about, it's like, oh, these are the Japanese films you have to see. Very often they're not comedies, or if they are, they're comedic, but they have other elements. A lot of Kurosawa's films are very comedic, but they're not comedies. They're action films, or they're thrillers or something like that. And so it's much more like, no, this is serious. This one is not like, oh, this is serious. There are serious elements to it. Like, they're all in all comedies. But yeah, I think that you're right. It's very... it is very comedy of manners a little bit. Like, it's got those edges of like, oh, everybody's not saying what they really mean. Mm-hmm. And you've got the whole scene with the two of them walking in the moonlight and talking about the moon. And it's so fucking corny on the one hand, but on the other, you're just like, you like each other. Like, you do, we know what's going on here. And yeah, and that kind of that sort of arrangement, if we're going to get these two people into the same space and make them take a walk together, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a very sweet film.
It really is.
Yeah. And I also think another aspect of Kenyo Tanaka's films is that the costumes are really precise and really well done. Even in the Love Letter, where like the run-down suits that the main character, the older brother, is wearing in Love Letter, and the way he ties his tie, it's really show a lot of his character just in how he's dressed. Mm-hmm. And the costumes in The Moon Has Risen are really beautiful, and also say a lot about this time in post-war Japan, where Western influence is coming in, and some of the characters, female characters, wear kimonos, and some wear more Westernized dress, and some switch between the two. And so when we first are introduced to the characters, the older widowed sister-in-law is wearing a kimono, as is the middle sister, and the youngest sister is wearing a more Westernized skirt and blouse set. Throughout the film, the middle sister switches between kimono and more Westernized clothing. The oldest sister-in-law is exclusively in kimono, and there's only one scene where the youngest sister is in a kimono. And so I think that that is another element of the storytelling that Kinuyo Tanaka understood really well. And these sort of subtle looks at the changing face of Japan. One of the plot points of the romantic interest for the middle sister, he's in Nara because he's studying microwaves to help send better phone calls across Japan. And there's a great scene up at a sort of radio tower, and the way she films that modern bit of architecture as beautifully as she does the temple scenes. And it's just a really beautifully shot film. Production design, the costume design, and the cinematography, in addition to really being very charming.
Yeah, absolutely. And it feeds into what you were saying earlier about those micro generations, that, you know, you've got the generation that went, that were adults, right? So she loses her husband in the war. You've got the generation that kind of remembers it better. And then you've got the much younger generation who were children, really, like, definitely did not experience the war in the same way. And so you've got these kind of different levels, and then everybody kind of coping with the changing face of Japan and the fact that they have to, you know, it has to change because that's just the nature of the society, et cetera. And it's all kind of tied together by the chanting that the father is engaging in with, I think it's also with a priest who comes like every day or every other day or something like that. And the father who's being very disconnected in a lot of ways from the changing that is happening and is sort of accepting of it. He's kind of like, well, yeah, it's going to go on. This is what's going to happen. But yeah, it's a really, really well done film. And Karen, I think that you're quite right, that it would be a good foray into kind of different, you know, I always recommend Kurosawa films to people who have never really experienced Japanese filmmaking because they're so intense and kinetic and recognizable. But this is a much different speed and is really enjoyable in a very different way.
Yeah. And much lighter than her other films. So and it's a good intro point.
On that note, you know, for a minute there, I was struggling. I was just like, do we want to end on probably the heaviest film that we're talking about here? But I think we kind of do. It is one of her later films and is, in terms of just the strength of it, the power of it, I think is it's one of the best. Like I haven't watched all of her films, but it is, I think it's definitely the best film that I have seen of hers, just in terms of like subject matter and again, going back to that empathy. So yeah, this one is Girls of the Night, also called Girls of Dark. Which is about, and I think that many people can guess what this would be about. It's about prostitutes, and specifically about the reformation of prostitutes after prostitution has been, brothels have been outlawed, prostitutes have kind of been driven back to the streets, and there is like this cultural push to get prostitutes rehabilitated, put into reformatories, and then eventually integrated back into, you know, quote, mainstream society. Away from being prostitutes, basically. And it particularly focuses on Kaniko, played by Chisikawa Hara. And she is remarkable. Like this it is her film in so many ways. It takes a little while for us to really get to know her, but she shifts between personalities and between milieus so incredibly well. And it is about her kind of trying to move from the reformatory to actual professions and the struggles that she has to go through, largely because of other people's perceptions and attitudes towards her, the fact of her being a former prostitute, and all of these questions revolving around whether or not she should tell people, whether or not, you know, she should let them find out for themselves, you know, how she should engage with this, and the really difficult and painful things that she has to go through as a result. So, Karen, why don't I throw this over to you to see what your thoughts are? Because I was like devastated by this film, basically.
Yeah, it's pretty, it's a lot of movie. It's very, very good. And again, with the beautiful way that it's filmed, I mean, it's just, Tanaka has such a great eye for the visual storytelling element of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. But thematically, yeah, this is a devastating film in so many ways. And I think that out of all the three that we're talking about today, and I think just looking at films of this time period too, I mean, this comes out in 1961, I think. It's rare to find a movie that is this blunt, I think, about experiences of women who are kind of victims of the circumstances of the time period, who have to make a lot of choices and are very judged for them, and struggle to rise above that judgment. And mm-hmm. And I think that it just really captures that experience and the feelings that come along with that, just so well. It's in many ways for me, it was riveting to watch these women, and to really be on this journey with them, like struggling to find acceptance in society again.
And also not, you know, the film does not, again, dwell on the suffering. So as we were talking about earlier, that there is violence, and there is some pretty distressing violence at one point. Mm-hmm. I was like, Jesus Christ. There's a lot of humor as well. There's a lot of, you know, them kind of the way that different women, some women are just like, I want to get back out onto the street immediately. Like some women are just like, you know, have actually very happy in the reformatory, or like, I just want to stay here forever. But there's a lot of humor going back and forth between them and kind of them having good relationships with each other and complicated relationships with each other as well. But it doesn't dwell on like, you know, these poor women having this horrible time being women. It's just like, yes, but also they're happy with each other. There's a lot of laughter. There's a lot of connections that are being made. And also the film very clearly points out the hypocrisy of it. There's a lot of discussion of, you know, why aren't men in here? Mm-hmm. Why aren't the men having to be rehabilitated? That this isn't just about, you know, the women having to fix themselves, but the fact that not just the men who are pimping them out, but the men who are buying their services, the police officers, the men who simply kind of are like, oh, you're lesser than, you know, and there's an entire wonderful sequence with Kaneko's first job where, you know, we see kind of her trying to be what she should be and not being able to succeed at it, not because of anything that she's doing, but because of the way other people are treating her, not just the wife, but also the man who initially appears very sympathetic. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a gorgeous film, very empathetic film. So Nanina, what are your thoughts initially on Girls of the Night?
Well, as you said, it is a hugely empathetic film, which is incredibly important to the way that the story is told. But also your point about their allowing there to be lightness within mm-hmm. this film. To prepare for this, I also watched the Mizoguchi film Women of the Night, which starred Kenyuyo Tanaka. So I thought, which was from 1948, and I thought that would be an interesting look at a film that she was in, she knew well, and its take on prostitution in Japan. And it is really, really bleak. And yes, Girls of the Night has a really troubling scene of assault that is women on women. Women of the Night has three of those. Not quite as deeply felt, but just the number of times of, yes, we get mm-hmm. it, that women can be incredibly cruel to other women, but there is also solidarity between women in similar situations. They're not always like trying to tear each other down, which I got the sense from Mizoguchi's film that was the main thing that I was pulling from it, other than the two main sister characters in that film. All of the relationships between the women were really horrible to each other. While in the third place that she goes to, which is more successful from a lot of different reasons, but one of them is that she has a friend with her at that last third place, and the relationship between her and the other young woman that's also trying to take back her own life is really beautiful, and the two of them living together in this little apartment that they have in a temple annex, and sort of reminiscent, actually, of the domestic situation between the two brothers in Love Letter, of cooking for each other and being a support for each other.
Yeah.
And yes, it's important that her job is much less toxic, and that she can have that friendship, and the importance of female friendship in allowing her to have the support to move on with her life, and for her friend to have the support in order to move on with her life, because the friend is in a much better situation.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And I think that, you know, and it's that final thing, because it isn't just, I was going to say, so in the first two instances where she has these jobs that wind up being not good, and she is alone, she's isolated, she does not have anyone around her that understands her experience, and different people kind of seem to empathize a little bit, but then it goes horribly wrong fairly quickly, and then her reaction to it is to get angry, is to get tough, it's all that, you know, and it absolutely makes sense. But when you get to that final job, not only does she have this support network, she's got this other person who understands kind of what she's experiencing. She also has several other people, male and female, who are, you know, there's never that scene where she's like, I have to tell them now that I'm an ex-prostitute. Or anything. It's not like the same kind of emphasis. It's much more subtle, and it's much more like they're aware, and it's like it's okay. But at the same time, we then also get that it's still not going to be easy. It's just easier. And that's one of, I think, one of the really difficult things about this film, is that it's never easy. It's not like you want it to end in a certain way, and it just doesn't, and it's not going to. And I knew, I was like, this is all going to go bad. I just noticed. And it doesn't go bad, but it's very, it doesn't give the same kind of payoff that maybe you want to have in a perfect world.
Yeah. Though it does subvert things at the very end. There's an expectation just in how the shot is set up, and then that expectation gets subverted. And I don't want to give away the end, but in a way, it's a more hopeful ending than it might have been.
And
she's reclaiming her humanity and her life.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's such an important point. And I think just with this film, you know, we were talking about how it is a devastating film in so many ways, but also it's not bleak, and it's not going to leave you just completely hopeless at the end either. And that's such an important thing for Tanaka to do with this film, is to leave it where you do have a little bit of that glimpse of, okay, this isn't going to necessarily always be terrible.
Yeah. And I think really briefly to just talk about the, you mentioned, Nanina, earlier, the assault, which is really the only real, like, serious violence that we get in the entire film. And it is a group of women, like, going after her because they think that she's been sleeping with their boyfriends, and they're like, and it's very well done. It's not a very long scene, but it's a very intense scene. But one of the things that I liked about the way that it was dealt with was the aftermath, that so the directress, who kind of comes in and, like, learns about what happened to her, the way that all of the women, you know, she, Kaneko goes home. She goes back to the reformatory, and all of the women just immediately are rallying around her. There is this like immediate solidarity and connection that is happening. And then the directress goes in and is like, it's not just, you know, this shouldn't have happened, but like, how dare you kind of thing? How dare this happen? How can we, you know, how can we actually help these women if this is the sort of world that they're coming out to? And it's very well done, and it's very emotional and intense. And there isn't this like, there's never this moment of like, well, what did you expect? You were a prostitute. It was like, no, this should not happen to people, regardless of anything, right? And it's very like, I think it's even more devastating as a result of that, because it isn't just dwelling in the violence of it, it's dwelling in the aftermath of it and really looking at the empathy that the other characters have for her, and the way in which the women actually do like rally around each other from all walks of life, from all of these different spaces. It's incredibly well done. So are there any final thoughts on Girls of the Night before we close this one out?
It's just a really powerful film.
It really is, yeah.
So empathetic, and it's hard to watch at times, but it's not a slog. And also, I watched it with Joe, and he was like, they fit all of that into 93 minutes. Like, today, that film would be 2.5 hours long, but it's really well-paced. It doesn't feel rushed. It doesn't feel slow. And it tells this really complex story and character study in a relatively lean amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah. Such a good point. And I also just, if we didn't mention it now, I don't remember, but all three of the films that we've talked about, plus a few other Tanaka films, are part of a collection that is available on the Criterion Channel now, and people should watch all of them.
And I was very excited to see the Criterion logo come up at the start, because they don't do that just when it's on the collection. They do that for things they're going to release. So I do think eventually, I have no inside knowledge, but I think eventually these will be available in a box set.
Probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and given that what she only directed 6 films total as a feature filmmaker, so you know they all appear to be available now. So all right, I think that is going to close us out for this week. Nanina, thank you so much for being with us. I'm sorry about some of the technical issues we've had, but I'm saying that now, and I'll just be like, oh, none of our listeners are going to know it. Yeah, it's like we had technical issues.
What technical issues?
There were none.
It was perfect.
I made it to the end.
You did, but thank you so much for being on. So do you want to give any shout outs to any place people can find you or not, if you don't want to?
I'm on Twitter at Nanina Gilder and on Blue Sky at Nanina, because I'm the only Nanina there apparently. And I'm also on Letterboxd, so
cool.
Find me there, and I mostly deal with early women directors.
And you have a depth of knowledge that always puts me to shame. You will say things, will be like, I've got no fucking idea what you're talking about. Like, you just be like, well, so-and-so. It's like, I've no idea, but all right.
And I can go on and on and on and ramble sometimes at you.
And we love it.
Yes, unlike the rest of us. So thank you so much for being on. And of course, we want to thank all of our wonderful patrons, who include Abby, Ali, Brian, Connor, Estefania, Heather, James, Judy, Carriata, Matt, Michelle, Monty, Nanina, Robert, Steve, Sharon, and Tao. And yes, thank you so much for supporting us. If you'd like to become one of their number, our Patreon is patreon.com/citizendame. And we also have an Etsy store. That's etsy.com/shop/citizendamepod. And we do have a Ko-Fi. It's ko-fi.com/citizendame. And of course, you can find us in many different ways. We have our website, citizendamepod.com. Karen's got some new reviews up there. Definitely check those out. And you can also email us. Our email is citizendamepod@gmail.com. And of course, you can find us on the various socials. We are across Twitter, Instagram, and Blue Sky at Citizen Dame Pod. And we are a Letterboxd HQ at Citizen Dame. And you can find lists and recommendations and also links to various articles and the podcast itself. And of course, you can get in touch with us individually. Karen, where are you?
I am on all the socials at Karen M. Peterson.
I am on limited socials at LH Business. And that will close us out for this week. Nanina, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I had fun.
We did too. We love having
you. We did too. Yes. Come back anytime. And we will talk to y'all later.
Bye.
Bye.
Takadeni, aoki jimufuku fukare yuku. Haha niwa haha no kanashimi arite. Atashi, shoryu kajin nante naritaku nai no. Tada nonna de kekkou. こんな惨めな自分見るの。